This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week, we come to you from Las Vegas, and in particular, at the Park MGM at Nomad. And one of the reasons for that, of course, is the annual Virtuoso Travel Week. And for those of you who are regular listeners to the show, you already know what I'm about to tell you. It's madness. It's 6,515 people having, I can't even calculate the number of four-minute meetings. It's speed dating on steroids and then some. And what are they all talking about? The largest industry in the world, in particular, luxury travel. And joining me now, the chairman of Virtuoso, Matthew Upchurch, how are you, sir?
Great to be back here with you.
And we do this every year, Matthew.
We sure do.
But now this year, we have new buzzwords to talk about.
Yes.
Right? We have buzzwords like over-tourism.
Mm-hmm.
We have buzzwords like currency fluctuation. Mm-hmm. We have buzzwords about, once again, trying to redefine what is a luxury travel experience. And everybody here is doing just that, right? You're competing for an audience that has higher expectations, higher demands, maybe more money in their wallet because the economy is doing better. But coming with that comes, how do you define what luxury travel is in a way that people will have a better experience?
Well, I think the one thing that we really focus on at Virtuoso, and the reason, and by the way, I can give you the calculation, 278,000 minutes, appointments, I mean, and that's 1.4 million minutes, which is 2.7 years and 4 days.
Okay, so who's counting?
But who's counting? Yeah. But the purpose of all that, actually, it does kind of answer your question because, you know, as the diversity and the size of the market has grown, the definition of luxury has changed dramatically from the perspective of there is no one, you know, size fits all. And I think that what we focus on is the value of the travel advisor's ability to really understand the needs and desires and even the unrecognized needs and desires of the customers and being able to match it with the kind of products that will actually satisfy them. Today's travelers are very sophisticated and they're not linear. I mean, different trips demand different things that they want. And I think it's important that this type of relationship building that we do actually changes the experience for the traveler. Because when we send somebody, and I send you anywhere in the world, and I actually have a personal relationship, you know, there's just something else that happens that's quite magical.
Well, let me give you an example. Recently, believe it or not, I came across the actual documents from the very first trip I ever took with my parents, 1962, and it was a letter from the travel agent to my mother, typed single-spaced on onion skin paper for those people who are old enough to remember what onion skin paper is. And it gave us our minute-by-minute itinerary, which we followed without ever asking a question. Right? There was no conversation.
Right.
Hey, we're going to go to Europe. Tell us what to do. We'll do it. That's it. That kind of equation has changed.
Well, absolutely. And I think one of the biggest mistakes that people might or misconceptions is a lot of people think that, you know, who think that going to a travel advisor is because you don't know what you're doing. Actually, today, travel advisors are incredible collaborators, and their power is not just, you know, you're not there because they know everything and you know nothing. In fact, our customers come to us incredibly well-traveled, incredibly well-researched, and the point of the relationship is to actually collaborate, utilize our networks, utilize our relationships, have the community knowledge of what we do all over the world. You know, we have actual specialized companies in over 120 countries. So it's no longer about, you know, I can find you a guide. It's like, I have a special guide that you're going to love.
And you have a conversation.
Absolutely. Well, that's a big one that you've always said. I mean, The art of the conversation and having deeper, more meaningful conversations is one of the ways that you can improve travel. You know, because you can read all you want. I've said this for a while now. You know, we live in an era where answers are free, and they're pretty much worth that sometimes. I think one of the most incredible things great advisors do is they ask really good questions, and they make the client think of things in different perspectives that improve the outcome of how they decide what to do. They throw in ideas they may not have thought of. They refine programs. And like designers, there's all kinds of nuances in sequencing of trips, how to do that. We just had a great story that I talked about. Somebody had never used a travel advisor, and I thought one of the things that was fabulous was when they came back, they said, you know, by having had this and having felt so cared for and being so organized within a framework, and in that framework you can also have all the free time you want. He goes, but you know, this was the last trip that I took with my family before my youngest went to college. And for the first time, I was able to be completely present with my kids, not having to worry about everything else and me having been the one that arranged everything. So it's this great collaboration between the advisor and the traveler.
Of course, it's about giving up control.
Well, but you know what? Control is an illusion anyway, right? Especially in travel, because things are going to happen. It's about having somebody having your back, because in travel, it's not, you know, it's not if something's going to go wrong, but if something does happen and there's some disruption, it's knowing that you have somebody that you can rely on that's there to help you out. One of the greatest things, as you know, when we have major kind of disruptions like the volcanic ash issues and things like that, a lot of times we get more business because that's when we prove our mettle, right? When somebody's got an issue and, you know, and your advisor has already rebooked you before you even landed while everybody else is trying to rush to the customer service desk.
Well, speaking of customer service, that being the oxymoron of the year, the key issue in the world of travel, which is the service industry, is not the delivery of the service, it's how you recover.
Absolutely. The best loyalty, I mean, obviously you want to deliver fantastically, but I can 100% tell you that the deepest, most loyal relationships are made when something goes wrong and the way you recover, because that's when the chips are down and that's when you realize the kind of organization you're dealing with.
I always try to tell people, travel being one of the largest industries in the world, arguably sometimes the largest industry in the world, I look at it as news. So I'm not there to promote something. I'm there to present information in a credible way that hopefully then people can make intelligent decisions about the choices they want to make. Hasn't that changed the dynamic of what your advisors do as opposed to being selling travel versus presenting it?
Well, absolutely. Because, again, it goes back to this whole idea that our job as advisors is advice, you know, not, you know, in fact, you can call us experts, but the problem is that you can find all this information and again, I think it goes back to this whole thing about asking really good questions. And so it's not just about telling you what it is, but it's about making you think about introducing new things, new combinations and things like that. Also, the value of a travel advisor is before, during and after the trip.
Really, especially great. After.
Well, exactly. I've been on this soapbox for years. The very best advisors, the reason they built such great loyal relationships is that when clients come back, they debrief. And they don't just ask a generic question like, how was your trip? They ask something specific, like, if there was anything you could change about how this trip was, you know, went, what would it be? And that's a much more inviting question. And then when they open up, if I do my job right, I learn, I nuance, and then the trip keeps getting better and better. And with every trip, my knowledge and my ability to serve you and be more thoughtful in how to make how to deliver for you just keeps getting better and better.
How many advisors are here right now?
We have 3,083 advisors from about...
Again, who's counting?
Yeah, well, not that I knew. And about the same number of our partners. So we do these one-on-one. We do 4-minute appointments in the morning, which was a kind of a grueling form of speed dating. And then we do matched appointments in the afternoon where advisors and partners ask for each other.
And how much business is being done?
We estimate somewhere between $500 million and $800 million comes out of this every year.
And everybody shows up.
And everybody shows up and it keeps growing little by little. Last year was the first time we actually had to close it down. We now take over Bellagio, Vidara and Aria as far as their convention space.
But to put this in perspective, 22 years ago, how many showed up?
22 years ago, let's see, I'd say maybe about 800. So it's grown a little bit.
Can it grow too much?
Well, what we're doing now is we actually do smaller versions of Virtuoso Travel Week in different cities around the world. Some of them as small as 200. The next year's program in Sydney is going to be almost 1,000 people. So probably in a couple more years, we'll have, 6,000 here and 1,000 in Sydney, and who knows where it goes.
You were talking about working, when we just went to the break, with WTTC, the World Travel and Tourism Council, to come up with the data to support the stuff that you're doing.
Right, and you were asking us what was one of our biggest challenges. So the data I was referring to because of the overall growth of tourism. So one of the biggest challenges we're dealing with is we've actually introduced a product called Wanderlist, which is a digital platform that allows people to kind of the gamification of capturing your travel dreams. Well, why are we doing that? We're actually trying to get our customers to think about where they want to go in a longer period of time. So we're coming up with 2, 3, 4, 5 year plans. Doesn't mean it can't be changed. But through that process, as tourism grows, it enables us to actually work with our customers further out in advance. And, to do luxury travel and to do experiential travel, if we have more time, it used to be like, oh, I'm going to get a great deal if I went to the last minute. Well, guess what? The best places in the world, they're getting sold out. And they're there. You want to be a little more strategic and a little more purposeful in trying to figure out where you want to go when, so that we can be more proactive in booking these things further in advance.
All right. Well, speaking further in advance, where do you see the growth patterns in terms of destinations or experiences?
Well, first of all, just look at the airline numbers. I mean, we're about to go from, 4 billion to 8 billion tourist trips in a year. So there's tremendous growth in overall tourism,
But where is it going?
Well, it's doubling.
Talking about specific directions. What destinations are the hot ones that you're seeing as you're compiling these wander lists?
Well, first of all, anything that's quote unquote exotic, those kind of destinations. But we see it in two patterns. We see that the general pattern is people want to go back to familiar places, but they want to do it differently. They want to experience it in different ways. And then there's this pool. So there's always this kind of tension between our clients, between the pool of familiarity of somewhere that they love to go back to, but they want to do something different, versus the pool of, going somewhere that they've never been to before. So there's a lot of, one of my favorite destinations in the world is Africa. Africa's doing really well right now. Then you look at places, a lot of hot places, Mongolia, Bhutan, some of those areas like that. The other destination that's been super hot over the last couple of years and getting hotter right now is Japan. Obviously, we have the Olympics next year, but I think that one of the reasons that Japan is so hot is that Japan is one of those places in the world where you really still feel this uniqueness of culture. And I think that because they were the second largest economy for so many years, they were a bit like us. Like, I don't need to change every sign into English. We're in Japan, right? You come to my country, you deal with it. So there's, in some ways, it's kind of interesting because it's become an attraction. Because you do feel when you go to Japan that you're in this culture and you really are infused in that culture.
When we talk about places that are growing, now we get to talk about over tourism. You had a seminar on that at your conference. Bottom line is you have countries or cities that are making public statements about banning cruise ships from certain ports, about closing down certain cities, about fining people for sitting down at the Spanish Steps in Rome. I mean, where are we right now with that?
Well, I mean, obviously with growth comes these opportunities and these challenges. And I think that, first of all, what we talked about is just our responsibility as advisors and just trying to educate our travelers, with respects to culture and what's appropriate. But one of the things that we shared this morning on the luxury side, which tends to be some of the more seasoned travelers, we were able to go into our data warehouse and actually see that since 2008, the percentage of our clients traveling to places in what's called off-peak, in 2008, it was like maybe 15% more than peak, and that number has doubled. I mean, it's sort of, so more and more of our clients are not going places in the very peak season. Which actually is a good thing. I mean, and they're sophisticated travelers. I personally love
Paris in January works for me.
And you know what? A lot of people underestimate. I mean, because in a lot of those times, or those quote unquote off peak times, it's the cultural season. It's the time when you get to, you know, really interact with the locals in a much better way. So I do think there's a lot of things that we all need to do. I mean, there's technologies and policies. You know, we talked about some of the city centers that are being closed that, you know, made pedestrian. So I do think it's a joint effort, but I do believe that it is the ultimately is the self-determination of the people of a destination that need to decide what it is that is right for them.
But it is a double-edged sword. They want growth, they want revenue. In certain countries where the GDP is almost totally dependent on travel and tourism, you have an internal battle going on that nobody wants to close the door because they feel they'll just go broke.
Well, and that's where, and you're right, but then the flip side of that is that if you are dependent on that, and you don't,
you better manage it.
Then you won't have a product. So necessity is the mother of invention.
Well,
and I'm actually very hopeful about it.
Well, short of putting turnstiles in St. Mark's Square in Venice, hopefully we can figure out another way.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic...
My next guest is a New Yorker. In fact, we just realized we worked together at NBC. Didn't know it at the time. That's how big NBC was. We were on different floors back at 30 Rock. But then somebody got smart and hired him to come out here to become the president of entertainment and sports at MGM Resorts. George Klafkoff, how are you?
I'm doing terrific. Thank you.
What does this job mean?
This job primarily is overseeing MGM Resorts' 37 publicly ticketed entertainment venues. So my group does the booking, marketing, ticketing, and operating of those venues. And then I also happen to oversee our sports betting and interactive gaming and sportsbook businesses.
Wow. That's a lot of stuff to cover.
It is. It's fun.
It is. It's one thing to come into a situation like this and have to cover all that, but then you have to you're developing stuff at the same time.
That's right. Always trying to find the next new act, trying to bring in new interesting things for our guests to go and see.
Well, let's start about the old interesting things, because some of those things persevere.
Yeah.
What's the one thing, sort of like, you know, what's the one thing a chef is never going to take off the menu? What's the one thing you're not going to take off the menu?
Well, we've had a great 25-year run with O at the Bellagio, which is kind of the preeminent of our Cirque du Soleil shows. We have 5 shows, soon going to 6 with Cirque du Soleil, but O's the original and the preeminent show, and we actually just added more cast so that we can go to 7 days a week sometime next year.
And then, of course, what's happened in Las Vegas all around the place, not just at MGM, is the word residency.
Yes.
Right? You have to see Celine Dion or Elton John or Cher.
Yep.
Who have you bringing? Who are you bringing?
Well, we hope you see Cher because she's at one of our properties,
right.
The Park Theater, which is actually in this building.
Right.
And in addition to Cher, we have Janet Jackson and Lady Gaga and Aerosmith and Bruno Mars. And we'll soon be announcing quite a few more for 2020.
Now, what does residency entail? They're here for how long?
Well, it's different for each act, but primarily means a recurring set of performances where they come in for a couple weeks at a time. They may play 5 or 6 or 7 performances over a 2-week stretch, and then they'll come back every couple of months or every quarter.
And they stay at the hotel? They do not.
They stay at one of our hotels.
They do? Sure. They
yeah,
stay in-house?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because in the old days, they didn't. In the old days, they put them out in some mansion out there near Wayne Newton's house. You know?
No, we have beautiful suites and places for them to stay long term, and they're very comfortable. And I think, you know, for the artists, it's a great opportunity to put the money and the investment into creating a great show and to be able to have their fans come to them as opposed to have to travel around and find their fans. You know, with a city that gets 42, 43 million visitors a year. You know, every week we have 800,000 new people coming into the city looking for something to do.
And you got the tickets for them.
Absolutely.
In fact, last year, 8.6 million tickets you sold.
That's right.
To how many different events?
To over 8,000, over 8,050 live events, yes, last year in our 37 venues.
And so 24/7 when you think about it.
Yes.
Is there any time you're actually dark?
There are no days of the year where we don't have shows.
Nobody takes a day off?
No.
What about prize fighting? For me, that's sort of like this kind of a curve. It's either really big or it's not.
Well, I think every 3 to 4 months, we have a big prize fight in Vegas. And because of the nature of the properties that we run the 3 largest arenas in town, Those always happen on our properties, and we love having them. They drive a lot of our business. We bring in a lot of gamblers. We bring in a lot of tourists who come just to see the prize fights. And I think historically, Vegas has been kind of known for prize fighting, and that was the beginning of Vegas as a sports destination. That's how it started. But really what we've become is the sports capital of the world, right? We are adding professional sports. It seems like every 6 months, we bought and moved the WNBA team, the Las Vegas Aces here.
You have hockey?
We have one of our tenants at T-Mobile Arena, which is the largest arena in town that we run, has as a tenant the Vegas Golden Knights, who've had a tremendous...
By the way, their last season was unbelievable.
Both of their first two seasons, fantastic, and in their
They almost made it, man. They almost.
Went to the Stanley Cup Final, almost won, yeah. And, you know, we have the Raiders coming just across the street from our properties.
And you're building the stadium there right now.
Yeah, we're not building it. The Raiders are building it. But it's uniquely located just across the 15 highway. And it's about a three-minute walk to Mandalay Bay. And we're incredibly fortunate that we happen to own the 8 closest hotels.
Gee, what a surprise.
What a surprise. What a coincidence.
And you'll be selling those tickets too?
We won't be selling the tickets. The Raiders will be selling the tickets directly. We're really about putting together packages for fans who are going to be coming for the game, whether they're Raiders fans or fans of the visiting team, and we'll be putting on the best tailgate the country's ever seen.
Although I have to tell you, I've never forgiven the Raiders because they left LA twice.
Yeah, well, we're really happy to have them coming here.
Cool deal. So is there any sport, you don't have an NBA team yet?
We don't have an NBA team, although we are home to the WNBA All-Star Game as well as having the Aces. And then with the NBA, we do quite a few programs during the year. We almost have 12 months worth of programming. The Summer League is here for the whole summer every year, and we just got done with USA Basketball. And in December, we have the G League coming in. And so we have NBA players coming through our properties all the time, and we love it.
We're talking with George Kliavkoff, the president of entertainment and sports for all the MGM resorts. Is there a celebrity here that you've not been able to get?
No, really not. I mean, there are celebrities that we want to get that we're working on, but no one has said no.
No one. Without naming names, what's the most ridiculous demand a celebrity has made?
Oh, you know, they're actually really good to work.
I'm not going about having the red M&Ms.
Yeah, the red M&Ms
in the thing. Yeah.
We don't run into that. We do run into particular issues with folks who like one of our properties or another property to stay at. So sometimes we have to clear some room space for folks. Then we have bands who have multiple people in the band, and we want to make sure we're treating all the band members equally.
No, there are bands with multiple personalities, disorders in the band.
That sometimes happens. We've been
really
very fortunate.
You really think?
We've been really fortunate.
But I mean, I love to see the contract writers in some of these deals where they're asking for, you know, just like black licorice or something.
No, that's an urban myth, I think. That doesn't happen that often.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. What's the one act that you thought would just do okay that went through the roof?
Well, I think we're very fortunate on our timing of signing Lady Gaga. Well, we signed her before her movie came out, and we signed her before some of her performances, and I would say that that's just been off the charts. Lady Gaga has turned out to be the hottest thing in the world just as we were opening her residency. So that's more timing than anything else, but she's been fantastic.
And is there a performer that you will allow to go longer than an hour?
Yeah, of course. Most of our performers go a little bit longer than an hour. We don't do two-hour sets, as you know, in Vegas. We like people to get on to the next thing, and folks want to do multiple things while they're here for a few days. So it's symbiotic in that way.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
I am always impressed and never surprised anymore about how Las Vegas continues to reinvent itself, not just in terms of the infrastructure and the buildings, but in terms of the shows. And joining me now, the president of events. I love this title. He's the president of events and nightlife. Can nightlife have a president?
Absolutely, it can.
It does, because he's got the job. Sean Christie, how are you?
I showed up. They gave me the title.
I like that title.
Yes, thank you.
I would like that title just to be able to walk up to people going, excuse me, but I'm the president of nightlife. What does that mean? What does that job mean?
Well, I think over the years, as nightlife has evolved, it really just means experience. And it means how customers, after a certain hour, connect. So in many ways, it means hospitality. It means lifestyle. And it kind of means the 2.0 of the way that people like to, you know, have fun after 9 p.m. at night.
And of course, in a city without clocks, that could be anything.
It can, and it's actually evolved into, over the past decade in this town, I think around the country and world, into what we would refer to as day life, but then I'd have a really long title.
How'd you like to wear that jacket to work tomorrow morning? As a matter of fact, I would.
That's right.
But let's talk about that, because like 5 or 6 years ago, it was the pool scene. Everybody had cabana. It was cabana stuff and the nightclubs, right?
That's correct.
I mean, I was seeing figures. I think Las Vegas, I think, is the single largest consumer of Absolut vodka. I mean, and not in the small bottles, by the way. We're talking the big ones, right?
Liters.
Yeah, and they come by the trainload.
They do.
It's unbelievable. So what's changed since then? You still have a huge pool scene, right?
Yeah, you know, coincidentally, I think that the pool scene means many different things, just like restaurants do, but the pool scene is actually still growing. Just because people want to be outside in better weather, especially in the areas where in the Midwest or East Coast in March or October, we're still 70 degrees here. So in many ways, it's grown.
What's interesting to me is if you look at guest surveys around the country in terms of hotels, the two things that people will always say they want is a health club and a pool, and they never use them. Here they do.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, here they use both, because I think Las Vegas has really, over the past 18 years that I've been here, but specifically the past 10, I think the idea that you can come here, have a good time, and still, you know, enjoy yourselves and have wellness, Park MGM would be a, you know, pretty much a direct example of that.
Explain.
Well, we host regular yoga sessions out at the pool. There's a prolific gym.
At 11 o'clock at night?
Not at 11 o'clock at night, 11 o'clock in the morning. That's the 24-hour thing.
Right.
So I think the idea that, you know, back in the day, you know, when I first got here, again, around 2000, the pools weren't really a thing. So in many ways, maybe you just slept in. And now I think that time is precious. People are here for 2.5, 3 days, and they want to make the most of it.
And if it's an opportunity for them or an experience, they take it.
Experience always wins.
All right, so let's talk about, we know what's happening. What's not happening? Meaning, what did MGM and the other operators think was going to be a cool experience that didn't fly?
Well, I think the only way you learn is to fail forward.
Sure.
So there's a countless amount of examples of things that have not worked, but maybe have spun off other things that have worked. So
give me one example. Yeah.
Well, you know, God lives in the details, and so it's all about execution. So we've got a great new thing opening at Mandalay Bay called Happy Place, which is, you know, kind of a new age idea of interactive environments where people come in, have experiences, basically take pictures and things like that. And I think that earlier execution of that might be art installations and more traditional gallery setups that didn't have the teeth that consumers are looking for now. I do think those things are important, but I think that as you look towards the next generation of consumers, the idea that I can interact with, almost physically touch, and then share with my friends on my phone experiences, that is an example of what was and what is.
So basically, we're living in the world of Instagrammable everything.
I believe that at a certain age, or below a certain age, or not excluding people, because my grandmother's 94 years old and she's obsessed with Facebook, that now it's not good enough to just have something good. It has to be visually pleasing as well, and the standard has been raised higher as a result of that.
And it has to pay off.
Has to pay off. And I think that when you do something with that in mind, that the consumer, you're kind of checking all five senses. And so the idea that you've set it up for things like your phone on Instagram is just another layer, but it still has to be good. Otherwise, people don't care.
So part of the experience that you guys are trying to work on here is essentially a plug-in.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it all goes back to the way you feel. Because if you feel a certain way, you're more inclined to share that regardless of how it looks. But if you combine how it looks with the way that you feel or the way that we tried to make you feel, that's where magic is then created.
I remember way before your time when MGM opened up their theme park, a total disaster. I mean, it was so bad. And now, of course, that's no longer there. By the way, they gave me a coin when I came here then that gave me a lifetime entrance to that park. I want answers.
I think you need a refund of some sort.
But I still have the coin. You know why? Because that reminds me of what didn't work sometimes.
What a great memento. Riding along in my automobile. My baby beside me at the wheel. Cruising and playing the radio.
With no particular place to go. Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. We're always interested in travel trends. I get inundated with statistics on an almost hourly basis about what's up, what's down, ranging from Donald Trump's tariffs against China to the value of the rand, the pound, the euro against the U.S. dollar, and, of course, how it benefits you or necessarily how it impacts you, good, bad, or ugly. And joining me now, Senior Vice President of Leisure and Independent Advisor at the Ovation Travel Group, Gina Gabbard. How are you?
Good, Peter. How are you?
Good. Well, you know, I'm going to go right to the source because you guys are the booking agents. You guys are getting the phone calls. You're getting the inquiries. People either saying where they want to go or demanding where they want to go, one of the two, right?
Correct, yes.
What are the trends that you're seeing? I mean, I see right now, if you're just following the power of the U.S. dollar, I mean, we all want to go to either Argentina or South Africa. It is such a buyer's market.
Absolutely. And, you know, we find that so many of our clients are loving Argentina. They're loving even Peru. So South America is extremely hot. We're also seeing...
And by the way, to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, the buying power of the U.S. dollar against the Argentinian peso is 7 times more than what it was just 6 months ago.
It's amazing.
And we're not talking about airfares or hotel rates, which can be adjusted. But what can't be adjusted is basic goods and services that the locals have to pay for, whether it's a taxi ride or a night on the town or a tube of toothpaste. That's where you benefit as a traveler.
Absolutely. You know, I would tell you that for a lot of our travelers, they're really looking for those local experiences. And so when I think about the different destinations within South America, there's so many beautiful local experiences that people can have. So that's something, too, that they're really loving these days.
Well, see if you agree with me on this. I mean, I say this as an embarrassed American, right? Mm-hmm. Americans are the most geographically ignorant people on the face of the planet.
Agreed.
I mean, they do not own an atlas, and if they do, they use it as a doorstop. I mean, they don't know where, you know, it's like the couple that comes back on a vacation. Where'd you go? Aruba. Where's that? I don't know. We flew. Okay, yeah. So we got that part.
Right? Correct.
So you have to educate your own clients, not just in terms of the experiences they want, but giving them just a sense of place as to where they're going.
Absolutely. And we do that from a variety of ways. You know, obviously our travel advisors are very well traveled themselves. So we even talk to them about, you know, the easy connections or maybe the nonstop flights. For instance, a lot of our travelers are out of the Northeast. So out of New York, we're very fortunate to have a lot of nonstop flights around the world. So it's even how long are the flights, how quickly can we get them into the destination and experiencing everything it has.
I mean, given the new extended range of so many different aircraft types, I like to laugh when somebody says to me, oh, I don't want to go there, the flight's too long. I said, no, be happy you can get there. And the bottom line is I always take the longest nonstop flight I can get because who wants to break it up 6 times?
Absolutely. You want to get there as quickly as you can.
I know. Now, the nonstop flight from Singapore to Newark, that's an interesting flight because they finally got wise at Singapore Airlines. They don't even have an economy class on that plane. It's Economy Plus, mm-hmm. where they show you photographs of people dead in economy. I mean, because that's a 19-hour flight.
Yeah. You need to be in business class.
Can I see that? Can I hear that again?
You need to be in business class.
You know what? People beg every day.
Yes.
But seriously, even as a former college kid who learned how to sleep on the tray table, I've still developed what I call my center seat zen. I don't care what my boarding pass says, what my airline reservation says. I'm convinced I'm in the center seat next to the two sumo wrestlers. So what I do, is I just realize, okay, I'm going to be sleeping on the tray table. And then if it doesn't happen, I'm pleasantly surprised. And if it doesn't happen, I'm not upset about it because I wasn't expecting more.
Do you travel with your own pillow?
No.
I do.
Really?
Absolutely.
Does it have a name?
Yes, it does actually. It's called Slip. So it's a silk
you
pillow.
You named your pillow?
Well, no, that's the actual brand.
Oh, sorry. Okay,
but fine. Yes, it's a silk pillow, which is so nice. It helps you sleep no matter where you are. A nice little silk eye mask. You can go out like a light anywhere.
What I do is I have the industrial strength Darth Vader headphones. I mean, I look
okay.
like Rick Moranis right. in Spaceballs, okay? And for me, that works for me because I'm sending a message to anybody around me, don't talk to me, and I'm having great concert sound, mm-hmm. concert hall sound, and I'm done with a good playlist. You can
That's
do
good, yeah. You always have to have a good playlist.
Are you seeing changes in people in terms of their booking patterns on the seats they want on the planes?
Well, certainly for a lot of our clients, we are seeing them take at least at minimum economy plus, but most of our clients are loving and they almost demand business class or first class, depending on the aircraft cabin.
You know, it's almost a reverse psychology thing, the way airlines are pricing their seats and positioning their seats as, let's pick the least abusive, mm-hmm. right? The least violent, right? Like, they'll show you the first price on the website, which is the dreaded draconian basic economy, and people don't realize that until they book it and realize all the things they're not getting.
Yeah, no changes, no baggage.
Right, yeah. No breathing.
Yeah.
I mean, right?
No food.
Well, I can live with that. But the point is, people, if they're going to book on a website, they better understand page 5 of the website.
Exactly.
Because if they don't get to page 5, then they're going to get sticker shock.
Correct. See, that's where we come in. And travel advisors are really there to help take the traveler through that experience and really guide them so that we can make sure that they're going to get exactly what they want and then some. We're really anticipating the needs.
So basically, if I call you on the phone, your first response to me would be,
Could be.
Could be,
yes.
Now, you talked about Argentina, mm-hmm. South Africa we talked about. What are the other great bargain destinations?
Well, I think when you talk about bargain destinations, it's about the
value.
Correct. Value for your money. Because of the strength of the dollar, we're seeing still incredible amount of business going to Europe, especially Portugal, Spain, and Italy. For us, still very hot.
Well, Portugal's been hot for a while.
Yes.
Spain and Italy and France have always been hot because everybody who books it is a failed art history major. You know it. I know
Correct.
It. Okay. But Portugal, now, the new one that we just did a radio show from, mm-hmm. the Azores.
Oh, nice.
That is the hot destination now.
We are selling some of it, yes.
Yeah. And Delta now has a nonstop.
Correct. They do.
Yeah. And the flight from New York to the Azores is less in terms of time than New York to L.A. It's totally manageable.
Iceland is still hot. And even though I know that a lot of people are still going.
I've had it with the Blue Lagoon, okay? Come on. But you know what? Get smart. Now we do the Faroe Islands.
Mm-hmm.
That's hot. And believe it or not, in the summer months, Greenland has a lot to offer.
It does. But you know what? If you stay closer to home, and we are finding a lot of our travelers are also wanting to stay, you know, stateside, you've got Utah. You've got Big Sky, an amazing lodge that has opened. You've got Montana. We're even seeing some of the destinations that people consider for ski. They are looking at it during those what might be considered lower season.
Sure.
It's beautiful.
There be a rapid change in cabin pressure, oxygen masks will automatically drop from the compartment above your seat, free of charge. And to start the flow of oxygen, pay your flight attendant $75.63. My mother, God rest her soul.
Joining me now in person, usually we do it on the phone, is the travel editor of the Wall Street Journal and a regular on this show, as well as our television show on PBS, The Travel Detective, the travel editor of the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Scott McCartney. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Peter.
You know, everywhere I go these days, whether it's going through clear at the airport, many airports around the world, like in Doha, and they're starting to do it with the TSA as well, it's mm-hmm. facial recognition time.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of good to it, and there's a lot of questions about it.
There are a lot of questions about it, and it's interesting. Airlines and airports are going full speed ahead with this. You're now going to run into facial recognition for boarding flights on JetBlue in New York, on Delta at most of its hubs by the end of the year. In Atlanta, they have a whole what they're calling a biometric terminal. You can use your face to check your bag, to go through TSA screening if you're on an international flight. And to board the airplane. And no boarding pass, no passport, no driver's license, just your face.
So I understand the seamlessness of it, the one-stop shopping of it.
Yeah.
But it certainly raises a lot of questions as well.
Well, it does raise a lot of questions. It seems the questions sort of center around there are concerns about accuracy of it. And Customs and Border Protection, which is actually running the database that makes this work, they say they're actually seeing higher accuracy with it for two reasons. They have better lighting and controlled conditions, and they're only comparing your face against people who are booked on the same flight. So it's not like you're going to randomly match to somebody 12 states away.
You know, at the airport in Doha, I went through their system.
Mm-hmm.
The minute you get to the airport, it reads your face. You put your passport away. You never take out an ID through all the other places you're going to have to go through to check its identity management.
Right. And this is really sort of the other privacy concern. The airport, in a sense, is an environment where you don't have privacy to begin with. You've given them your personal information. You've given them your picture with a passport. But this notion of scanning the crowd and using facial recognition is really what people are concerned about. And the question is, if it does this expand from the airport to federal office buildings, to crowds at presidential rallies? The Secret Service is already starting to use it. Does it expand to the subway, walking down the street? And so the question is, how much is the government going to know about you? Are they going to know lunch?
And how are they going to use the information?
And how are they going to use the information?
I mean, right now, I don't think there's a word called an alibi left, because they'll know if I went through the toll booth. They'll know if I went to the ATM. They'll know if I went to the store and bought something at the CVS pharmacy. They're always, unless the cameras aren't working, there's always some sort of a digital record.
Yeah, I've been thinking about it. We're here in Las Vegas, and wherever you go in a Las Vegas hotel, you're on camera. I mean, and if they applied facial recognition to that, they'll know where I am at all times, where you are at all times, and a lot of people are uncomfortable with that.
The trade-off here, and it's not always a comfortable trade-off, is to what extent do you want to trade efficiency and speed for privacy?
Yeah, that's exactly the trade. Now, in the case of airports, CBP says the pictures that you take at boarding or at baggage check-in, they only save those for about 24 hours, less than 24 hours, to make sure nothing happens with the flight.
Well, they say that, but let's go back to the days of the body scanners when they first introduced them at the security checkpoints. And it turns out there was some guy named Vern in the back room who was looking at somebody's genitals.
Yeah. No, there are those concerns. There are pictures they do save. If you're a Global Entry member, this was news to me. If you're a Global Entry member and you put your fingerprints in, but you also look into the kiosk and it prints out a picture, supposedly so that the officer knows you got the right ticket. But they save those pictures and they build a gallery of you. And every time a foreign
is it possible
national
to purchase that gallery and put it on the coffee table book? Or you know what? You could actually do that. There are enough frequent flyers out there. I promise you that if the DHS said, you know what, we have the last 55 entries you have to the United States in a beautiful glossy book, would you like it with the date and times that you flew? People love to be able to say, I'm a frequent flyer. Here are my pictures at different airports looking disheveled after a 9-hour flight.
Yeah, and the good news, if there is good news in this, is that the more pictures they have, the more accurate it gets. So they have your disheveled look. They have your comb-over look. They have, they have your beard. They have you clean-shaven, and it really does get better. If you're a foreign national and you enter the country, they take a picture of you every time, and they save it for 75 years.
Just in case when you're 105, you might not do something right.
Well, that's right.
Well, the bottom line is this. They're rolling it out in Atlanta.
Yeah.
They've already started that.
Yeah.
Give me a time frame here.
I think really over the next year, you're going to see it more and more and more. So Delta's in Atlanta, Salt Lake City, Minneapolis. By the end of the year, they're going to have it in all their hubs. Air France says, just one example of one airline, Air France says they'll have it in all their U.S. gateways by the end of 2020. Over the next 12, 18 months, this is going to become the norm for international travel, not just from the United States, but as you've experienced all over the world. And I think it's going to take some getting used to for a lot of travelers.
It is. We're talking to Scott McCartney, the travel editor for the Wall Street Journal. I remember in the early days of the body scanning machines, you had the right to opt out.
Yeah.
You had the right to say, no, I want a personal pat down. I don't want to go through the machine.
Right.
Can somebody opt out of this?
Yeah, absolutely. And they say, and we'll see, that it always will be optional. Now, the problem with the body scanning machines is they make it really inconvenient to opt out. And there's a lot of concern among privacy experts that you end up with the fast lane and the slow lane, and you essentially punish people for opting out. The way Delta's doing it, that doesn't happen. It's very interesting. They still have the gate agents at the gate. If you walk up to the gate and you want to opt out, You simply present your passport, and you do it the old-fashioned way. The time savings in this is that the gate agent on an international flight has to match your name to the manifest and has to eyeball your passport photo and make sure that you are who you say you are. Automating that is a whole lot more accurate, but you can still do it the old way. Just hand them the passport, and they'll send you on through.
And by the way, I'm a big fan of something called pre-clearance, which is in about a number of airports, started in Canada back in 1950.
Yeah.
But you see it in Ireland, you see it in Abu Dhabi, Bermuda, the Bahamas, where you actually clear customs and border protection of the United States in those countries when you come back.
Right.
And the same protocols would then apply.
Yeah, and this is it's a different thing when you go through CBP as opposed to just boarding a flight with the airline. Although you're using ultimately the same facial recognition, same database, but the CBP is certainly using facial recognition more and more, both for foreign nationals entering the United States, for U.S. citizens going through, and you'll see it in the pre-clearance locations as well as in the U.S. locations.
And the good thing about pre-clearance is if you are a problem, if you are a security risk, they can determine that before you ever board the plane, and you're not going to transport somebody to the United States only to discover it then.
Yeah, no, that's why CBP likes it so much. They get to vet you in person before you get on the airplane, before you get to the United States. There's an expense to it. They're stationing officers overseas at all kinds of different locations. Often the location will help pay for it.
Oh, in many cases, the location pays for all of it.
Yeah, because
they did that in Abu Dhabi.
It is a great thing for travelers, but it's also good security.
I am waiting for them to do it in the high volume airports, Heathrow, Charles de Gaulle. That's where I need the help.
Yeah, and that's where it's a whole lot more difficult, just because of the volume. You need a lot of real estate to do it in Heathrow to set up U.S. screening entry checkpoint, and you need to be able to segregate all those travelers from others, and so you essentially have to create a U.S. terminal.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
My next guest actually acknowledges being from Jersey City, but he's moved to Las Vegas a long time ago. In fact, he's worked here so many times, he's come back again permanently as the executive chef at MGM Resorts. Anthony Omarosa, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate being
here. What does this job mean? I mean, how many different hotels are you overseeing?
It's funny you ask. I was trying to count them out in my head before I walked in the room because everybody does it on a different number. The easiest way to look at it is everything domestic, so everything here within the States. I count it and make a number easy for myself as a round number at 20 resorts with about 400 food and beverage outlets as a whole.
So basically when you're ordering eggs, you're buying farms.
Whole entire farms out of, probably all the eggs available out of one state, yes.
I mean, the consumption figures are usually staggering, right? What's the one consumption figure about what you order for your hotels that surprises you the most?
I think in some cases, it's probably the items that you would expect to see higher volume in that possibly are lower. Eggs probably isn't as outrageous as we like to believe. Orange juice, those kind of things where you think like these are the daily consumables you would see high numbers in.
Okay, orange juice you're buying by the tanker.
Orange juice we squeeze by the tanker. So if you've ever been to the grocery in the summertime when they have the big giant bins of watermelons, those are about 750 pounds. Most of the properties go through about one of those a day just to make orange juice.
Wow. Now, obviously in the world we live in now, sourcing is not the challenge it used to be. So you can just about get anything you want, even if it's not here, flown in every day.
I think... Yes, you can get anything you want from anywhere via air or ground. Our challenge has become volume. I think sometimes because the volume is so large, procuring one specific product that maybe everyone in the company might want to have access to, you get surprised really quickly on what is and isn't available in those volumes.
So what's your biggest challenge?
Once you start moving into a higher tier, right, availability for prime beef or antibiotic-free or organic and such, the the consumption level across the country has grown. Obviously, our consumer consumption has grown, but production hasn't necessarily caught up yet.
So basically, kale.
Kale, antibiotic-free chicken, organic eggs, those type of things. We have to reach out to multiple suppliers to make sure we don't have supply chain interruption.
And, of course, 10 years ago, nobody ever said the words gluten-free.
Also true. Very, right? Very true. Having all that available and having it, obviously, at the scale that we produce is a bigger challenge than common, you know, maybe oranges for orange juice.
See, I'm always looking for opportunities. So I would want to open up an all-gluten restaurant, and I want to call it Gluten for Punishment. No? Okay.
No.
It's a thought. But it's not just the food that you're working on. It's the concepts of the F&B.
Our team is very much involved in all these sort of concepting from the ground up for wholly sort of owned and concepted all the way to any partnerships that we form with named celebrity chefs. We work with those teams very closely, sort of understand our market and where they're going to fit within the portfolio of the building, in within the city, or you know, if it's in another city, how that fits in you know, a place like Springfield or National Harbor. Our process may be a little different than what it is at their corporate team's process, so integrating them also comes through our office. So we handle it from conception all the way to ideation to realization stage. We work through all of the trainings, and then obviously our team is very heavy on the procurement, and we are often, you know, promoting internally our talent to sort of staff those areas where those that are coming in from an outside can't bring a chef or bring an operator.
We're talking to Anthony Omarosa, the executive chef for all the MGM resorts. In a world where everybody's a celebrity chef, you're dealing with a lot of egos, you're dealing with a lot of different standards issues, and still trying to make it within the umbrella of your operation.
I think a lot less ego than is portrayed on reality television. Most of the chefs that we have the pleasure of working with, we have also have prior relationship with as operators. I come from a restaurant background. Our senior vice president comes from a full background, all restaurants working for, you know, celebrity chefs. So there's a mutual respect, I think, that happens with us and our team. I don't see a lot of that sort of back end, you know, ego that's like is portrayed in you know, shows on TV where people yell and scream. That doesn't actually really happen in our world.
But you also have to deal with elements of quality control, because if you're a celebrity chef with 18 restaurants, you can't be physically in more than one at a time.
And again, I think it comes down to, you know, us having prior relationships with a lot of those operators and those guys having the trust in us that we're going to do the right in every way possible by their product. You know, our job is to make sure that they, as the operator, deliver the product that we're buying, and their job as the operator is to make sure they deliver the product that we're buying.
Right.
So we have to work together to make sure that happens.
And you're squeezing all the orange juice that you have to have.
We do, yes.
At least for the last 15 years, part of what is identified with Las Vegas is Cirque du Soleil. In terms of an entertainment venue, they essentially own the town. They have six different shows that are running at any one time, a seventh about to start. And, you know, the definition of a great show is when you want to go see it again. In Broadway, of course, when you walk out singing the theme song. I have a couple of soundtracks from Cirque du Soleil, but I don't sing the theme song. But here, I keep on going back to at least one or two shows that Cirque du Soleil does every chance I get. Joining me now, somebody who knows all about that, the senior company manager for Cirque du Soleil, and a former New Yorker, by the way. Can I call you a former New Yorker?
I don't think you're ever a former New Yorker. You're a New Yorker your whole life.
Okay. A somewhat transplanted New Yorker,
there
Tony Ricardo.
How
are you, man?
Nice to meet you.
I mean, six shows. That's 7 days a week, just about.
Oh, it's 7 days a week. Yeah. Somebody's always doing a performance one of the nights. And I think Saturday and Sunday, everybody performs for obvious reasons. But
right.
we perform 7 days a week.
When you think of the evolution of Cirque du Soleil, especially, I mean, I've seen the show all over the world, but you see them all just about here. Are you breaking the shows here too? Or are you, in terms of introducing new shows all the time?
Oh, every time we open a show, it's different than the show we've opened.
No, what I'm saying is, do you use Las Vegas as an incubator?
Oh, no. So Las Vegas is its own sort of circus heaven and mecca. We don't start things here as an out-of-town tryout. Sometimes we actually bring them here. They're on the road. They're in a in some sort of a traveling venue, and then we decide to set up a residency here in Las Vegas, because it's many times it's almost more cost efficient to do that.
Now, when I say I come to different shows, but I like to come back to certain shows more than once, try not to laugh at me, but I'm a big fan of Ka. And the reason why I love Ka so much is different than your other shows. I'm in love with the stage.
Well, the stage at Ka is, it's unlike anything anyone has ever seen. It's a marvel of engineering. It's a marvel of theatrics. It's beautiful, and it gets the job done as a stage, too. I mean, you know, it's functional as well as its own piece of art. So if you love engineering and you're kind of that person, absolutely, Ka would be the show. And I was there for a couple of years, and I loved every minute of it.
I mean, that's a show where you specifically built the theater around the stage.
Yes. Well, on all of our shows, we've built the theaters around the show itself, with very few exceptions, O being one of them and Mystère being one of them. Every other theater was reconstructed to take Cirque in.
It was tailor-made.
But we blew out the back walls, we went into the casino, and we stripped it down to the absolute bare minimum, and then we put our shows in. Yes, and the results speak for themselves. If you've ever been in a Cirque theater here in Las Vegas, each one is its own sort of personality. And beautiful.
What's the lessons that you've learned about your audience after all these years?
That's a great question. The thing that we learned most about our audience is there are so many return visitors to Las Vegas. And like you said, so many people come back to Cirque time and time again. And they see one particular show, or they see all of the shows. So there, we try to remind people that there are 6-7 different shows, and it's not like, oh, I've seen Cirque du Soleil. Because just because you've seen one doesn't mean you've seen them all.
Well, speaking of that, you've got a new one opening up in October called Run.
That's correct. And that is geared...
But that's a different kind of a show.
That's a completely different show. I mean, we've almost stripped it down and started from scratch all over again. Traditionally here, we've done 90-minute performances. This is going to be a 75-minute format. It is geared not for your traditional Las Vegas visitor. I mean, we see the demographic of Las Vegas shifting, and we know that we have to provide entertainment options for across that spectrum.
How is it shifting?
It's getting younger. The attention span for people is getting shorter.
No
casinos
kidding.
Don't want you sitting somewhere for 90 minutes anymore, so they want.
They
right?
never. Excuse me. They never wanted.
They never
you
wanted you,
minutes.
But they were willing to go. They were willing to go for 90 minutes, and we've been very fortunate that our partners at MGM have, you know, they've supported everything that we've tried to do along the way. So we don't take that for granted. And they said, well, we'd like you to look at a slightly different format. We said, sure, we can do that. And I think we put together a beautiful show.
And this is not a show in the traditional Cirque du Soleil style of acrobatics. It's something, it's stunts.
Correct. This is something we also find it's a challenge, because people have such specific ideas of what Cirque du Soleil should be. And this is going to shock a lot of people. This is not your grandfather's Cirque du Soleil.
The charge for looking at this pamphlet is $3. The charge for looking at this pamphlet and putting it back quickly is $4.
My next guest has a title that most of you would probably die to do, and I would probably die trying. He's actually the corporate mixologist for all the MGM resorts, which means he comes up with all the interesting libations that are then marketed across the brand, but can also talk about, and I hope he will, trends about what's going on with people and their expectations about what they're doing at the bar, good, bad, ugly, and otherwise. Craig Shuttler, how are you?
I'm doing well, sir. Thanks for having me.
What does a corporate mixologist mean?
I'm still trying to figure that out.
Okay, give me a
shot. Day-to-day. So sort of oversee the programming from the guest experience in a beverage outlet to the cocktails to training the staff to selecting the spirits identity for the venue to...
Does every venue have an identity when it comes to spirits?
Depending on if the venue needs an identity.
So give me an example.
So we've got roughly 430 different venues where you can get a drink in our company, and some venues are a walk-up casino bar because that's just what they need to be. Some venues like Carbone focuses on rum, or John George focuses on international whiskey. Juniper at Park MGM, where we are now, is gin. Mama Rabbit, which we just opened last month, is tequila and mezcal. So it depends on what venue it is, if there's a need, and if the guests going to that would need a certain...
And of course, you know, for those people who remember the movie Sideways, you know, Merlot has had it, more or less. Then there was the big Cosmo craze for a long time.
Yep, Sex in the City.
Right. What's the hot drink now?
I don't think there... It's whiskey would be...
What, American whiskey or single malt?
It doesn't discriminate. It's pretty much all. American whiskey has definitely taken the boom. One, because there was a scarcity a little while back because no one foresaw the need for it. And then you can't rush it. You got to wait 10, 12, 15 years. So if you don't have enough, you just don't have it. And, you know, inherently everybody wants what you can't get. Japanese whiskey is still extremely popular.
The Japanese single malts have astounded me. They've done such a great job.
It's the Japanese way. They make everything with passion and with purpose. And there's just not enough of it, at least coming to the States. So it's one of those things that have become very difficult to find and highly sought after.
So single malts are doing great.
Yep.
What about bourbon?
Bourbon's doing great, too. You're seeing a lot more distilleries open up.
Well, that's what I'm noticing all across the country in some unlikely places.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a state now that's not doing artisanal bourbon?
If there is, there's very few of them.
Yeah.
If there's not, actually. But yeah, it's you know, still some of the big brands are holding strong. There's a lot of new innovation that you see in some of the ingredients that are being used to make the product. But it's great to see the diversity in the portfolio.
You know, we talked about single malt. We know about the Scotch, obviously. We know about the Irish. We know about the Japanese. But now we're seeing single malts being done in Tasmania, in Iceland. And then all across the United States, you're seeing states, Texas, for example,
yep,
that are doing American single malt.
Yeah. So just being the grain. So we're talking about barley. We're talking about single malts. But yes, it's definitely a category that was untouched for a very long time because the Scottish were king in that category. And then obviously the Japanese followed suit. It's great to see more, you know, even domestic and even places you wouldn't necessarily think can grow barley, producing some single malts that are fantastic.
Like?
Iceland would be an example. I was actually there last week.
Did you try the single malt?
I did.
And
it was good. I mean, when you take single malt, you're always comparing it to either a Japanese whiskey or a Scotch. So you're sort of doing it an injustice in its own right. But it's very interesting to see the sort of characteristic of it based on where it is being made and what the country, whether it's the water source or the agricultural practices that sort of give it a little nuance. And the woods are also another thing. What cask is it finished in? So it's really cool to see the many different offerings now.
All right, so let's recap. Merlot is toast. Cosmo was last year or last couple of years. I've also seen gin coming back with a lot of different artisanal distilleries popping up.
Yeah, definitely agree. I don't think gin ever went anywhere, to be honest. I think it was always there. It just got sort of foreshadowed by the whiskey boom because you can't rush time when it comes to whiskey. So in the gin category, you can make it, bottle it, and sell it in hours. Where it's always been a prominent, it's very big in cocktails. It's you know, most bartenders' favorite ingredient to do cocktails because of the botanical structure, and it's got some backbone, but it's not overly overpowering. So it's not neutral as vodka, but not as big as a single malt. So it gives us a lot of flexibility when we start creating cocktails.
So now I'm going to ask you to put on your prognostication hat.
Oh boy.
What's going to be the new hot drink?
The new hot drink. I think it's not going to be a drink. I think it's going to be an experience. So I think the clientele, the consumer now wants more than just liquid in a glass. You hear the Instagrammable sort of phrase. So it's more of what does the entire package look like? Not just here's a liquid and drink it, but what does it feel like? What does it smell like? What does it sound like? How do you interact with the menu? So Mama Rabbit, we have a very interesting menu that's a map of Mexico, and we break out all the distilleries in both Oaxaca and Jalisco on this elevation map. So think of a topography map. So each page is a different level of sea level, and it shows where the distilleries are, which then cross-references to the list of tequilas and mezcals, which is one of the largest.
So basically, Mama Rabbit means designated driver. I just want to make sure we're on the same page here.
Uber. It means Uber.
Uber, of course.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.